Good evening, and welcome to a MomsFightingAutism.com webinar. I'm your host this evening, Chantal Cecile Kira. I'm the author of numerous books on autism. One of my latest is Autism Life Skills, and also my most recent one is 41 Things to Know About Autism. This evening, we are going to have an evening where we are answering questions that are posed about special education and special education law. And our guest this evening was supposed to have been Areva Martin, who is the author of The Everyday Advocate, Standing Up for Your Child with Autism. But unfortunately, she is stuck in a case that she's been working on. However, I do have an attorney from her, Anna Rivera, who is an attorney in the office of Martin & Martin, which is the office of Areva. But I did want to talk a little bit more about Areva Martin and her book. Areva is a nationally recognized legal authority and expert on autism who appears regularly on the Dr. Phil Show, and she has been featured on other TV and radio show programs. She's a Harvard-educated attorney. She's helped hundreds of families gain access to services and develop coherent programs for their children with autism. She served as the vice chair of the California Blue Ribbon Commission on Autism's Professional Development and Education Committee. And I do know also that she has been working with the Senate Autism Committee because I've met her at a few meetings where I have been present as co-chair of the South County's Task Force on Autism. And one of the things that Areva does that is close to her heart is she has founded and is president of the nonprofit Special Needs Network. She's very active in the community of autism, and she lives in Los Angeles with her husband and three children, including a 10-year-old son who has autism. And so I'm happy that we have someone who works with her in her office here this evening. So hi, Anna. How are you?
Hi, I'm fine. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you for being here. Would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself and how long you've been working at Martin & Martin?
Sure. So I have actually been working at Martin & Martin for a little over a year now. Before working at Martin & Martin, I was at a nonprofit in Los Angeles called the Disability Rights Legal Center that focuses on advocating the rights of people with disabilities in all aspects of law. So I happen to focus on education and special education services, but at the Disability Rights Legal Center, we did cases on, program accommodation, physical access, any kind of aspect of law that would affect somebody who had a disability and wanted to have an equal access to a program or to a facility or any kind of service that would help them, you know, better integrate into the community. And so I have been working in the area of special education for, I guess it's been about 3 or 4 years now.
Mm-hmm. And do you have a child with autism or any type of special needs, or how did you become interested in this field?
I don't have any children or a child with a disability, but I was always interested in the area of education and actually started working at the Disability Rights Legal Center right after law school, and was interested in the intersection of juvenile justice and education, and how many times students who have special education needs end up kind of on the wrong side of the tracks, as we'll say, and end up getting in trouble, being disciplined for things that really are kind of related to their disability.
Right.
And so they get, you know, regulated as the bad kid and sort of get dismissed, not only because of their disability, but now because they're being suspended or expelled and kind of, not given the right opportunities that they need to be able to be successful.
Which, yeah, exactly, which only makes the situation worse for them as they get older.
Exactly.
Yeah. And can I ask you a question about, in terms of special education and minorities, but I was wondering if you find that there are higher incidences of, say, minorities who will get in trouble instead of being actually given the help that they need in terms of special education.
I think historically there is definitely even in identification of students with disabilities. I know that there has historically been shown that students who are minorities, it takes longer for them to be identified as having autism, and they're often misdiagnosed as having mental retardation or not even diagnosed at all. And it's not until they're 5 or 6 or 7 years old that they actually get an appropriate diagnosis. And so there's a big window of time that gets missed. I do think that there does seem to be, besides misidentification, sometimes there's a reluctance of certain communities to ask for evaluations, to know what to ask for, to sort of accept the idea that there might be something more that's, you know, troubling. They don't know who to ask or exactly what to believe when people tell them. And so I definitely think there's an education component that's missing about making sure that parents know what to ask for and where they can go to access resources to be better informed about what they should be expecting of their children and what they should be expecting of their school districts.
Right, and it's not just education, but it's really outreach, too, because it's specifically also if you're speaking about people who whose native tongue is other than English, mm-hmm. even though we have access to a lot of materials in different languages by law, it's still, as you say, that whole cultural idea of going outside of the community to get help and who's reaching out into the community to make them feel that they have the right to ask for this help and that it's not a bad thing to do.
Right. It's definitely important, I think, to have people from within the community who know how to reach out to those families and provide that kind of education so that people feel comfortable talking about what their concerns are and feel that they have someone who they can go to get information. Because even though, you know, there might be a flyer in their native language at the school district, they might not feel comfortable, you know, asking particular questions, or they might just be kind of suspicious of the source of information, you know, because you kind of doubt sometimes that the district is really giving you the full scope of the kinds of information that you want. And so it's nice to have a kind of a third party like a nonprofit or some other community organization out there providing that information.
Now, before we start going towards answering some of the questions that people have sent in, because there are quite a few, I did want to ask you if you're familiar with protection and advocacy, because each state has kind of a protection and advocacy office.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in the state of California, I know that if you go in on this website and you go in the references section, you can see all the special education law rights written out in a very simple manner. They're written as questions in lay languages, and it's translated into something like 26 different languages.
Right.
Really a wonderful resource for people, so I kind of wanted to mention it on the air, and I know that a lot of, every state has a protection and advocacy office with free services. So it's really about getting the information out there that at least people can access that if they have access to a computer, if they can go to a library and get one, or you can even get a copy of one sent to you of this information that's on the Internet on protection and advocacy. So that's a good resource to tell families about if you know families that could use that kind of information. Did you want to say anything about that?
They are. I just want to echo your sentiment that it's a really great resource. Many of them have changed their name. So I know in California now it's called Disability Rights California.
Oh, okay.
So if people, you can search for protection and advocacy or maybe disability rights and then the name of the state that you're in. And they definitely have really great resources about special education, about other community organizations, links to local advocates, and all kinds of events and sources of information. They're really fantastic.
Yeah, because I just want to let people know that it's nice that you can go out and hire an attorney, but if you can't, it does take longer, but there is help out there. And you can actually also, at these offices, get information over the phone. Sometimes, I know in California, you have to call and you have to wait 3 or 4 days for an answer, so it's not a good thing to do, like, if you need an immediate answer, but if you have time to prepare, for example, for an IEP meeting or something like that, you can try and set up in a phone appointment to get some information or clarification in that way.
Right. And I do know that at least locally here in the Los Angeles area, we have several organizations that are like Disability Rights California or Protection Advocacy, where you can call in and although they might not be able to take your case as a legal services organization, they can help you in sort of identifying issues and telling you what your rights are and what your next steps could be, and kind of laying out a plan to assist parents, like you say, in preparing for their IEP meeting, or if, you know, they have questions about how to ask for a particular kind of assessment or what to do in a situation, that they can get some advice and information about those kinds of situations.
Good. Well, thank you for that. I always like to tell people about free information they can have, because it is, we have all these rights, but if you don't know your rights, then you don't know what to ask for. So
right.
It's possible to educate yourself, but it does take a little bit of time, but I do want to encourage people to feel that they're not all alone. There are resources out there to help them.
Mm-hmm. Most definitely.
Okay, so now we are going to go to some of these questions that have been sent in. And I did want to mention, first of all, that reading all these questions that have been sent in, we are going to be attempting to answer, or Anna will be, the questions that are specific to special education. And there are questions that have been sent in that really are not related to the topic, and we won't be able to answer those today. Okay, so Monica Lambert from Mobile writes in and asks, "Hi, at the beginning of every school year, we provide my son's general education teacher and special education teacher with information about him and his autism. We explain all there is to know about our son and his disability. We received our first progress report from his teacher, and he is failing all his subjects. What can be done about this, and why is it so hard to get support for our children? I am a supportive parent, and I go above and beyond to provide everything necessary for him." So what could someone do when they notice with the first progress report that the child is failing all their subjects?
Right. So I think it's great that they take the time, actually, to start that school year with introducing themselves and, you know, their child, and kind of laying the framework of saying, you know, we're paying attention and we're involved parents, we're going to be here. I will tell them that as parents, you don't have to wait until that first progress report. If you know, or if you're concerned that things aren't going to go well, or you think maybe the teacher isn't, you know, quite on top of paying attention to what your child needs, and you've had, you know, historically some problems with making sure all the services are there, you can always ask for regular meetings. And have them just be something that happens, whether things are going well or if there's a problem. So in this instance, let's say this is even before the first progress report, and you can set up kind of informal meetings every month with your teacher to, you know, check in to see how things are going, maybe mention trouble areas that you see with, you know, your son or your daughter having trouble with a particular kind of homework, or some, you know, a particularly bad day that they had, and to talk about what's been going on. Once you get a progress report and you see that things are not going well, definitely request a meeting with the school to have the teacher there and the other service providers, the assistant principal, you know, whoever are the regular parties to your IEP meetings, and come ready to talk about what's not working. And if you need to set up some kind of regular correspondence outside of your IEP meeting, like a communication log or like some kind of take-home report at the end of the week where the teacher can jot down notes and say, you know, today was a good day, today was a bad day, he, you know, is avoiding doing this in class, to start taking notes about what are kind of the red flags, if there are behaviors in class, or maybe it's just inattentiveness, or there's a particular subject that he's having trouble with, to try to keep the lines of communication open, so that you know what's going on. Because we'll often hear, you know, a parent will say, well, I got this progress report, and my child is failing, but no one told me. And when I bring in, you know, work samples, they kind of discount my opinion of what's happening, because they'll say, well, I'm the teacher. I see him during the school day. You don't know as much as I do, right? And which can be frustrating for parents, because who knows their child better than the mom and dad that sees their child every day and sees them struggle when they come home with homework? So you want to make sure to kind of create that communication line, but it's also creating kind of a paper trail, you know, of sending an email, of popping in and saying hello, and of letting them know that you're paying attention and that you want to talk about this, and to have some really concrete examples of what you think is going wrong, to stay focused in the conversation about what needs to change and what kind of strategies can be implemented to improve things.
So would you suggest that once the child is failing in the subject, you ask for a meeting and you go over these things with the teacher?
Yeah, you can ask for like a formal IEP meeting if you think that's what's needed to get everybody at the table, or, you know, kind of depending on the relationship that a parent has with the teacher and with the people at school, have maybe just informal meeting, you know, one day after school or one day before school to talk about what's going on. But I think either way, to come prepared with some, you know, specific questions about what's not working and ask for specific examples of, you know, what is it that's happening that's creating the failure? You know, are they not doing their homework? Are they not turning it in? Are they just failing every test? Because sometimes, I mean, I've had clients who, they do all their homework, and then they don't turn it in.
That's a perfect example of what a lot of ASPEs do.
Right? And so you think, you as the parent are saying, I know he did it. He did it
right.
After school. I sat there with him. It's in his backpack. And then you hear from the teacher that she hasn't gotten any assignments in the last 3 weeks. And so that's a perfect example of needing to have some kind of a better communication log or some kind of homework, kind of like a check to say, you know, Johnny turned in his homework today. I got it. Or I'm going to check his bag to make sure he turned it in today, so that they're getting credit for all the work that they're doing. It's just this almost like a minor glitch in the system, you know, to make sure that he's turning it all in and he's getting credit for that effort that they're putting forth.
And sometimes these issues can be resolved pretty quickly. Once you know what it is, you find some kind of organizational way to make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
A really good point, and that's why it's important to have specifics on why someone is failing. And you brought up another good point, which was the paper trail or documenting things. And I think that that's a really important point to address, to tell people about, because I just know from my experiences, okay, I filed for due process twice,
mm-hmm.
and once I did settle in mediation, another time on the first day of fair hearing.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, I had a very rock-solid case, and the reason why I had such a rock-solid case was because every time that I did something, I had a notebook that I kept by the phone, so anytime I called anybody or attempted to call, I would still even write that I attempted to call or that I got a phone call, and then every time I sent in a letter or received a letter, everything was in that book.
Right.
Even documenting, attempting to contact people so that you have that documented. And another thing is, in all communication to a school district or to anybody, it's a really good point to be polite. Even if you have a complaint, you say something nice, you give your complaint, and then you say something nice.
Right.
They can't argue with you when you're nice.
Right. And this is, you know, this is for any kind of communication you have. Even if you think things are going really well, you never know when there might be a problem. So it can never hurt, even if it's a short conversation that you had, you know, with the teacher one day after school where you've agreed to implement one of these new sort of organizational methods of some kind of checklist or whatever, a quick email or, you know, a quick note just saying, you know, thank you for meeting with me. I'm glad we agreed that we're going to do A, B, and C. And that's it. Really simple. It doesn't need to be anything fancy. It doesn't have to be confrontational. And your point about being nice is extra important when you're worried also about being made out to be that pushy parent.
Right.
Who's too demanding, because we often, unfortunately, you know, when things sort of get down to the nitty-gritty, it can be a tactic of a school district to try to make a parent seem unreasonable or seem like they're being too demanding, or flooding the school with letters and things. And so to the extent that you can try to avoid that and make yourself just seem like, you know, you're being polite, you're being civil, you're just doing what you need to do. We try to avoid, you know, giving them the chance to do that.
Sending the email like you just described serves three purposes. The first one is you say nicely thank you to the person, and then you're documenting what it is that you've agreed upon. So it's documentation of what was said. And secondly, it's a good reminder because you know what? The teacher probably speaks to, you know, lots of different people during the day.
Right.
And she just forget. It might not be that she doesn't want to do it. She might forget, and then she sees your email and she goes, oh, yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third thing is you do have that it's a nice opportunity to say something nice to somebody. So you've documented, you've said something nice, and you've reminded the teacher.
Right, right.
It's a win-win for that. And then you just hope she follows through. And if not, you know, that's when you keep sending another email.
Right. You're on your way at least of setting out that, you know, you've been trying to get things done correctly.
Yeah.
And so if it needs to go to, you know, that next level, you know that you sort of did your part.
Right. So here's a question from Candy in San Diego. My Aspie son is now enrolled in a small private school. Is it possible to me to access services that would be available through the school district? Specifically, I'm looking for speech therapy, social therapy, and occupational therapy for handwriting. Many thanks.
So when a parent has played, well, there's sort of two different responses. People use the term private school in two different ways. So some people talk about private schools and they mean a non-public school. So in California, a non-public school is a school that's been accredited by the state of California to provide services to special education students. And they're actually contracted with school districts, and a school district can place a student at this non-public school, and the school district funds their tuition at this school. It's a placement. People also mean private school to mean a completely private school, like a parochial school, like a Catholic school or any other just sort of school that offers general education services. And those schools don't usually have on staff a special education teacher or someone who has a special education, you know, credential or background. Students who are placed by their parents in that kind of parochial school, a completely separate private school, have different and usually very limited services offered to them. They have a different plan, and so it very much depends on the local area. But a parent can always go to their local district offices to get information about what kinds of services are offered to them. Because what often happens is that once a district knows that there's a student within their boundaries who's going to a private school, they're obligated to make their own offer of an educational program, and they will often offer a public school placement. You know, because that's the kinds of services that they want to pay for. So in choosing to not place your student in a public school, it kind of limits the kinds of other services that the district is obligated to offer.
Right, because there's a difference between a parent who chooses to put their child in a parochial, that type of private school, and the time when a parent has gone through the system and where the school district agrees to pay for the non-public agency school.
Right, right. And so her school district office should have information about the kinds of services that, because sometimes they do offer a limited range, especially of related services like speech and language therapy or like physical therapy, where it could be that she could take him to her local, you know, elementary school or high school, and possibly get a certain amount of those kinds of services at the school district. But it would definitely be a narrower scope of services than if he were attending his, you know, local homeschool.
Okay. So now here's another question from a concerned parent in Fresno. What do you do when your child is placed in a class with inexperienced staff that are not following the IEP? quality program exists at our local homeschool, which was listed on the placement offer, but as then we were told that the program was full, so we had to be bused to this inadequate class.
Okay.
Interesting.
Yeah. Inexperienced staff is definitely a common complaint. You can, at least for teachers in California, you can look up a teacher's credentials on the credentialing board website. So if the staff that she's talking about are either the teachers or the service providers, someone like a speech and language therapist or a physical therapist, anyone who's licensed by the state, parents can go to that website of the licensing board, and usually you can just put in that person's name, and it'll pop up on a list and let you know if that person has a license, when it was last renewed, for teachers, what kind of credentials they have, when it expires, all that kind of information, just so that, for their own information, they know who's in the classroom with their student. Whenever a parent has concerns with noncompliance, there are options depending on how aggressive a parent wants to be, right? So sort of the first instance could be that you see that maybe your student isn't going to therapy for speech and language therapy, for example, twice a week like they're supposed to. And maybe you think it's just sort of an odd oversight. You're still kind of hopeful it's lacking, they're missing the speech and language pathologist that week. You can write a letter, to the whoever your IEP administrator is at the school. It's usually the assistant principal, kind of asking them, what's going on, that you've noticed that they're missing certain services or some things aren't being implemented, and, you'd like to pop in one day to talk about it, have an IEP meeting to talk about what's going on and what the problems are. And then kind of to the ultimate point, in California, they're called compliance complaints. I would imagine that each state has its own procedure, but it's essentially a complaint with the Department of Education in which there's a form, but you're essentially writing a letter to the Department of Education. They have a specific unit that's in charge of these complaints where you, as a parent, let them know what your concern is, what part of this IEP that you think isn't being implemented properly, what's missing. You attach a copy of the IEP so that they know what's supposed to be provided, and then they open an investigation. And they actually, in California, are required to open an investigation for every compliance complaint they receive. And an investigator gets assigned, and they will contact the school to find out what's going on. They'll call the parent to talk about what's happening, and they'll try to reach a resolution. And the compliance officer, this person who's investigating, will create a report about what they found and what they're going to order the school district to do. So you as the parent, when you write your compliance complaint, you can say, my son is supposed to get speech and language therapy twice a week at 30 minutes each time, and it's been 4 weeks now that he hasn't gotten it, and, they just keep telling me that we don't have enough speech pathologists, and so I just have to wait. And I want them to implement the IEP, and I want compensatory education. And you can essentially ask for whatever you want. And I also, if they can't provide me with a speech pathologist at school, I want them to authorize an outside vendor to make sure that, my son receives consistent services. And then the Department of Education can essentially order any of those remedies if they find that, in fact, the school wasn't implementing your IEP properly. And
right.
School districts, at least in my experience here, do not like having compliance complaints filed. It makes them look bad. And so they will try to resolve it quickly. And if not, the Department of Education has the power to order them to give you compensatory services and start implementing the IEP properly.
So what about the second part, though, of this question, which doesn't make sense to me? How can they do that? How can they list the homeschool as the placement offer or the place where the IEP is supposedly going to be taking place? Mm-hmm. And once it's on the IEP, they're told that the program is full and they're bused elsewhere. Isn't that illegal?
It is. If they offered her the home school as the placement and the family agreed, that should be his placement. I mean, that's as the home school, a child is secured a placement at your home school. I mean,
right.
that's even as a general education student, you know, every
right.
student in your neighborhood, right, you have preference that you get to remain at your home school.
Right.
So she could, I mean, if this is a problem, she should definitely, and it's listed as the placement, you know, there is definitely a concern there that's not implementing the IEP, actually, to force her to change schools.
Right. So what would somebody do in that case? Who would they write to, or what would they, that's not a compliance complaint, is it? Because that's a placement.
Well, if they changed it without having an IEP meeting,
yeah.
I mean, that's a big concern. That can be a compliance complaint. That can be, a unilateral, what's called a unilateral change of placement, which could be potentially the basis of a due process request. They could, if the local staff at the school are the ones, you know, making those decisions, they can work their way up the chain. Sometimes I found that for some reason it's the local school level administrators that can't get you what you need. But as soon as you get a little bit removed and you start talking to somebody at the district office, they can get things done for you because, well, in some cases, they're sort of less emotional about what's happening, you know, because sometimes a principal or a teacher feels a little bit more attached to the situation. And so they don't want to change their minds because maybe they think that they're somehow they're giving in and it makes them look bad. So if there's a district person that you can go to or a complaint unit within your own district to seek a resolution, that could be a good place to start, you know, sort of at the low level.
Okay. That's good. Thank you so much. Here's a good question from Sibley. I'm sorry if I'm massacring other people's names. especially with the name that I have, I'm embarrassed, but that's okay. And this person's from Bel Air. When do I need to get an attorney versus a special education consultant? Would you like to explain the difference?
Sure. So in special education, which is a little bit different than maybe other sort of legal areas that people are accustomed to seeing attorneys, parents can represent themselves in every stage nearly, at IEP meetings, at a due process hearing, you know, at a mediation. They can go without the use of a consultant or an advocate or an attorney. A special ed consultant, if we're differentiating them between attorneys, are usually people who have who don't have a law degree, so they're not practicing as attorneys, but they have become essentially an advocate. They're a person with experience in special education matters, usually because they have a child of their own who has special education needs, or they have some other kind of background in working with children with special education needs, and they have experience in, you know, going to IEP meetings and sort of how the process works. And they work kind of as an advisor to lend support to a parent to make sure that they have access to information about how the process works and to kind of consult them and guide them along the way to give them advice about the kinds of decisions that, you know, a parent needs to make in the IEP process. Those kinds of consultants and advisors can't give you legal advice or shouldn't give you legal advice and can't necessarily, I mean, they don't they can act as your representative if you want to, but not in the same capacity as an attorney does. And there's definite sort of legal advice and analysis of the law and applying of law to facts that doesn't happen with an advocate. An advocate is almost, you can think of them as a person who has more experience in the area and a little bit more knowledge so that they can help you, kind of guide you through the process. Because either way, ultimately, a parent is the one that makes the decision. And so it just depends on, you know, what kind of assistance you think you need. If you just need some kind of moral support and someone to provide you with more information and you feel comfortable advocating kind of on your own behalf, you feel okay, you know, asking those kinds of tough questions and being a bit more upfront about what you want, then a parent could be happy with having some kind of consultant or advocate as kind of that person to go with them and to feel like they're supported in their effort. Oftentimes, at least in our experience, once you feel like your voice isn't being heard at all, and they need what they think as more, someone more powerful, I guess, maybe just even in their own eyes, people often look to attorneys if they think that things have really sort of gone to the point where they need someone who's more aggressive because they haven't been listened to.
Right.
Or if they think they're getting closer to a due process hearing, and it could be just a level of comfort that they feel more comfortable with an attorney at the due process hearing than a special education advocate. And so I think it really depends on people's comfort level and what they want.
There's a difference, too, I think, between a special education consultant, at least in some areas, versus an advocate, because, for example, here in San Diego, you might have special education consultants who are people who are knowledgeable about education specifically and different things that you can do to help support kids in the classroom, whereas an advocate is more talking about the rights without really being an attorney.
Right. That's true. That's a very good distinction.
And the other thing is this true? Because I know this was true years ago, and I know that they were thinking of changing this with some changes in the way they were applying IDEA. But in the past, wasn't it true that if you went to fair hearing and you had an attorney, then attorney fees could be reimbursed but not an advocate's fees? Is that still true?
That is still true. So the way the law is written, a parent has the right to recover their attorney fees if they're found to be the prevailing party at the hearing. But the law, the statute, is specifically written as attorney fees. So you have to be a licensed and admitted attorney in the state. And so then an advocate wouldn't qualify for that. And so a parent wouldn't be able to recover that money.
Unless sometimes there are advocates, and usually it's a good idea to have an advocate such as this if you think it's going to be pretty tough, is there are advocates that work closely with attorneys, so they handle certain aspects. But when they know it's getting to a certain point, they can work with an attorney's office, and so it's actually the attorney who will follow through. And once it gets to a part of, I always think of it as the part of no return, of filing due processes and things like that. But it is, I know for me it was a major consideration, the money aspect of, because I knew I had a very good case and I could win, but there was no way that I could afford to do it unless I knew I was going to get my money back. So,
right.
Besides the fact that I thought an attorney is more legally educated and could do a better job in the sense of the technical aspects of the law that I needed if I'm going to go to the point of being in front of a judge, there was also the money consideration that I would get my money back where I would not if I was going to go with an advocate. But again, sometimes you don't have to go that far. So
right, and there are lots of, or there are many law offices that have advocates as part of their practice.
Right.
And you can go to a law office that has advocates, and you know that advocate can go with you to the IEP meeting or to some other meeting and help a parent at the school level, and hopefully try to resolve it, you know, and at the same time they get to come back and kind of consult with an attorney if, you know, if something happens, if there's some issue that pops up, and that way you try to keep the cost down and not have to bring in the expense of an attorney if you can avoid it.
Okay. Here's Roseanne Guardado from North Las Vegas. My son has mild autism, and he is in a general education classroom. I feel strongly that he needs to be in a special ed classroom, and the school so far has fought me on this. My son is struggling to keep up. How can I be sure to get my son into a special ed program? They are reevaluating him soon, and somehow they always say he belongs in general ed. I'm his mother, and I know what he needs.
Right. So whenever we're talking about placement, such as the difference between a general education classroom and like a special education classroom or even something like a non-public school, those kinds of decisions or recommendations are often supported by the psychological assessment or the psychoeducational assessment that's done by the psychologist. So, you know, at the district level, it's the school psychologist that is doing a reevaluation. That even though the IEP team technically is the group of people determining the placement, it's pretty heavily, you know, weighed in favor of what that psychologist report is going to come out to say. And so, whenever a parent wants to challenge what they think is going to be the offer of the district, they need their own person supporting the position that they want. So for this mom in Las Vegas, if she knows that the school or she, you know, she highly thinks the school always comes back with this general education placement program for her, she always has the right, whenever a school district conducts an evaluation, a parent always has the right to ask for an independent evaluation. And those the jargon that you often hear is an IEE, which is an independent educational evaluation. And so for every assessment that a school district does, if a parent disagrees with that assessment and timely tells the district that they disagree, they can ask for an independent educational evaluation to be funded by the school district. And the district has one of two options. The district has to agree to the evaluation and pay for it, or they have to say no, and they need to file for due process to uphold the validity of their own evaluation. So a parent should always ask for, in writing, an independent evaluation and say that, you know, they disagree with the conclusions. And that independent evaluation is done by someone who's not an employee of the district, and as long as they're qualified to do whatever test it is that you want them to, a parent has the right to choose whoever they want, you know. So if you already know some psychologist or someone has recommended someone to you, you know, another parent at the school has experience with this and they've had their child tested by some psychologist that you'd like to go to, you can submit that person's name and that person will talk to the district and set it up. And as long as they have the necessary qualifications, like if they're going to do an evaluation for placement, they need to be someone like a psychologist. So it would be like an educational psychologist with that kind of, you know, appropriate degree and credential. That person can do that evaluation.
Yeah, and the thing I would like to encourage the listeners who are sitting there thinking, well, I wouldn't know who to go to, or I have no clue who the right professional is. There are plenty of autism organizations in your community, so whether it's the Autism Society of America or TACA, Talk About Curing Autism Now, or any kind of organization like that, there are parents there who use all the professionals, and you can find out by talking to a few parents what kind of professional is trusted by the autism community, and also for what type of child they're used to. So, for example, if you have a child who is has more the Asperger's type of situations, you would want someone who has experience with Asperger's, not someone who has experience with the severely impacted, unless they have experience with both. So those are the kinds of things you would want to find out about who you would ask to evaluate. Again, just make some phone calls because parents are happy to share the information with other parents.
Right. And then once you get names, and often a school district will, they often already have people that they know meet the criteria and that they have worked with before. So often when, at least here locally, when a parent asks for an independent evaluation, they'll send the parent a letter and it'll have some suggested names. They don't have to pick from that letter. But sometimes those people are perfectly good. They're not necessarily biased just because they end up on this list from the school. But the, you know, you as a parent always have the right to call and talk to them beforehand, just like, you know, you would with any other doctor, to find out what it is that they do, what they specialize in. If you just like the way they sound on the phone and you feel comfortable talking to them and you want to, you know, go visit them in their office and see how they work, and, you know, ask for references or what other kinds of, you know, cases that they do so that you feel comfortable in speaking to them, because they're going to be doing this evaluation and taking their own history. So you should feel good about who they are and that they're listening to you and your concerns so that all those things get incorporated into their report.
Right. Okay, Billy in Burbank. What do you do when a school district doesn't say what kind of services are available to your child through special education? Should the school have a packet of information on what's available?
That's a good question. In my experience, there's not like a menu, you know, if we can think of it that way, of every single service that's out there and available. I haven't seen one. I don't know that they have to make one. It is about making yourself educated just about your child's needs. And articulating the service that you want more based upon what you think the need is. So not to worry too much about what it might be called, because if for example, you said, you know, a parent came in and said, I think my son isn't speaking well and he doesn't say, you know, his R's properly, or he has trouble, you know, sitting upright in his chair or holding a pencil correctly. You know, all those things are red flags for a teacher and district personnel. And to anybody really reviewing the case as if it were, you know, a legal issue, that it should trigger in someone's mind, well, you know, this child might need speech and language services or they might need occupational therapy.
Right.
And so I understand, you know, the need that if you as parents, if you don't ask for it specifically by name, you're never going to get it. And one aspect, if that's the concern, I would suggest sort of getting to know more parents and talking about, you know, what they do. Talking to your primary physician, talking to people at the regional, at least in California, what we call the regional center, other community organizations and vendors of services about, you know, what the professionals call these services. And they can, you know, often they will give you the buzzwords. You know, sometimes there's just a buzzword that you have to use in that letter so that people know that you know what you're talking about.
Right.
So that they'll pay attention. But if you don't know what it's called, and you think there's some kind of service out there that your child needs, I mean, I think the best thing is to write down those concerns in as great a detail as you can, so that later, if it comes down, you know, that you're asking for things like compensatory education or something like that, that it shows that, you know, you gave them all the information you could, because as parents, you shouldn't be expected to know all the professional terms, to ask for some kind of specific test or the name of you know, something that's very technical, because that's just not your expertise. But if
now,
you can, you know, detail what all your concerns are so that you point the way, that should really be sufficient.
Now, speaking of complicated words or technical terms, you've used one a few times that maybe you should explain to our audience.
Mm-hmm.
Compensatory.
Yes. So in the special education realm, when you file a due process request, which is, you know, essentially like a lawsuit, but in an administrative sense, let's see if I can better explain this. In what we see, like, on People's Court on TV, when you file a lawsuit, you end up in front of a judge or Law and Order. We see, you know, a jury, and a decision comes back, and people will get, you know, money, or they'll get some other kind of judgment to make up for the wrong that happened. In special education, it's an administrative forum, so it's like immigration law. There isn't a jury. You end up in front of someone that's called an administrative law judge, and they have the power to decide your case, and they hear the arguments. It's like a mini trial, and they make a decision. And the law has said that in the special education arena, what was lost is educational benefit. And so the law provides for something called compensatory education, which is essentially education to make up for what was lost for the things that the school district did wrong.
Well, for example, if in the case of speech therapy that somebody wasn't getting for 6 or 7 weeks, then once they start up, they should be getting extra speech.
Right. So what what we would call that the makeup, essentially, of those 6 or 7 weeks, we could call compensatory education. Because it's not like you're going to start as if nothing was lost. The child lost 6 or 7 weeks. They need to make up that time.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Here's another question. Carol from Boothwyn, Pennsylvania. My son will be starting middle school, 6th grade, next year. He is high-functioning autistic and presently is bused out of his homeschool district to another school. Can I choose to keep him in the same district versus his home district? I am very concerned about bullying in our district. Do I have the right to choose what school he is to attend next year?
So normally, it's your home school district that has the obligation to provide those special education services. And so what she probably got was an inter-district transfer, which is essentially the district where he goes to school now agreed that he could come to their school, and his home school agreed that he could go to their school. So everyone is in agreement that he could go to this other place that is not his home school. It would depend on how often they need to renew that agreement. Sometimes schools ask that, you know, you have to get permission every year to get an inter-district transfer. So she would probably need to go to that middle school and see if they're willing, you know, to extend that permit to let him go there. 'Cause normally, a student who doesn't live within the boundaries of the school district, that school district isn't responsible for them. Like, they don't have a legal obligation to provide an educational program.
Right.
So you really have to sort of get everybody on the same page and agree that he can continue to go there in order for him to stay. So if either one of those districts actually were to change their mind, she might need to rethink that and think about what kind of program her home school district is going to offer her.
Right. That's tough.
Yeah, it is tough because there's a lot of, you don't have a lot of power to sort of keep him in a district that's not the one that he lives in.
Right. And the bullying issue is very tough because it's not like an educational support that you can take care of.
It very much depends on the individual circumstances and what. Unfortunately, sometimes it has to happen before you can address it.
Right, right. Here's another one from someone who's not happy with their teacher, Heather in Baltimore. We are not satisfied with our child's teacher skills. We don't think he is making progress. How should we proceed?
Hmm.
And always say that it's, the child's teacher's skills, though. The thing is, you probably have to document what areas the child is not improving and then assess what they can do to help him.
Right. Most definitely, I agree that there's, start keeping track of what he's not progressing in and what they think the concerns are. And if they really think it's the teacher or if it's actually the program, if he's in without knowing what kind of classroom he's in, if they think he would do better in a different classroom because the setup would be different, that maybe the mode of teaching would be different. But definitely if they're, to the extent that they can start keeping track of what their concerns are and what that lack of progress is,
right.
to bring it up at a meeting. I mean, unfortunately, it'll be about moving the student out of the classroom. It won't be about getting a new teacher for the class.
Right. And here I'm going to bring up this question because it's similar kind of concern. Lucy Antoine from Brooklyn, the speech therapist that works with my son, who's 23 months, has not made progress with my son. I want a more experienced person. How do you request a more experienced therapist for your child?
Yeah, so, right. That can also be difficult. If the person, so generally, if these service providers, like a speech and language therapist or even a teacher, are district personnel, it's very hard to ask for someone different because they're all considered, they're almost all considered equally experienced in the sense that they all meet the minimum requirements, you know, to either teach or to provide speech and language therapy or whatever kind of therapy. So it could be difficult to ask for a new person in that sense. If they're an outside provider, though, you can always ask to change providers. So that gives you a little bit more leeway. If you're going to an outside agency that your school is paying for, you can ask, you know, within that agency to change or to go to some other provider in that way till you have a little bit more leeway to ask for somebody different.
It is hard when it is the school district, and I have a perfect example. My son, when he was in middle school, came home with these huge marks on the front and back, his chest and back, and I took him to the doctor, and the doctor said, these are rug burns. And so the next day I asked at school, and it was the occupational therapist who was straight out of OT school who was doing sensory integration with my son, and she readily admitted that, you know, this happened during her session. No apology, but she admitted that it happened. So obviously what had happened is she'd been pulling. There's a thing you do in sensory integration that you do with little kids, mind you, not with kids in middle school, where you drag them around, but you're dragging them on special mats,
mm-hmm.
not on the rug where the T-shirt's going to pull up and give your child rug burns.
Right.
Okay, so I asked for an IEP meeting, and I asked them, and see how what a nice person I was. I was asking them only to bring in another OT with sensory integration experience with older students, the age of my child, and to overlap with this girl to give her the skill set that she needed, you know, to work with kids that age.
Right, right.
She sat there and said that she did not think that she needed any overlap. She did not need the training. And she was like, and the director backed her up. So that was the second time that I filed for fair hearing or due
right.
process.
Yeah, yeah. It can be difficult because they, you know, they begin to close ranks because they feel that you're attacking, you know, their employees
yeah.
as being inept, and so it's hard to come to a middle ground in that instance.
It's hard to sit there and hear a 24-year-old say they don't need any more. They don't need to learn anything new. And I just looked at her and I said, you know what? You're going to have a sad and sorry life because you're going to be bored to death.
Right. I mean, I think you were more than nice to essentially offer, you know, a professional, I mean, their professional continuing education.
No. Well, he's 21 now and he's still receiving outside occupational therapy thanks to that incident.
Right, yeah.
You know, they just can't remove it at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so, but just to tell you that these things do happen and you can try to do the right thing to begin with, and then when that doesn't work, then you have your legal attorneys to fall back on.
Right.
Here is a question from Star Lazaro from Houston, Texas. If my ARD docs say that lunch is non-instructional time and the school says that it is, and they are in process of changing the ARD docs for the rest of the students to state so, Can they do this? My son is 4, full inclusion, pre-K 4, 3-hour program at school. May I ask what an ARD is?
I think an ARD is a different acronym for essentially an IEP document.
Okay.
That's how I'm understanding the question. I think if the district is changing its policy about how they label lunch, as long as they're not violating a state law, they can do that, unfortunately, to relabel lunch as instructional time. So that would really be a question to find a more, a local sort of policy book to see what, if there's anything, any more local rule about what's sort of within the purview of the school district. Because oftentimes education law, both federal law and state law, sometimes they have detail and sometimes they don't. And when there is no detail, it kind of lets the district create, each district create their own policies about how they do certain things, as long as they end, at an appropriate place. So if there's no state requirement about what they can call lunch, instructional versus non-instructional time, then they've essentially left it up to the school district, to label it what they will. And as long as they're being uniform and they do it to all their students, then they can change their policy however they want to.
Interesting. Okay, here's a question from Kathy and Irving, and I'm really interested to hear what you would suggest here. We suspect neglect of our child. She is coming home with bite marks and bruises. What should we do?
Oh, wow. Okay.
Now, here the thing is, I'm just bringing this up, okay, but it could be that the bite marks and bruises are coming from other kids and not necessarily
right.
Staff.
No, that's true.
But then that means that they're, obviously not watching what's going on.
Right. So, it's neglect sort of either way.
What would you suggest someone do in this case?
I think they definitely need to take pictures and start documenting when it happens, going to their primary physician or doctor.
Sort of like what I did.
Yeah, definitely.
And the doctor actually took the pictures. I mean, I was just going there saying, what the heck could this be? And she said, take pictures. I'm taking pictures with my camera right now. And she noted in the file. So it's not just the parent who's noted it.
Right, right. So that you have multiple people who've seen it, especially with something like bruises, that tend to sort of go away.
Right.
Or people can downplay because they think, oh, well, they're kids. They get bruises all the time. If you can see a picture of it, you know that it's in an unusual place or it was a big bruise or, it just it strikes you as something that's not sort of in the normal course of a kid playing and getting a bruise.
Also, if a doctor sees it and it's in their file, it's another documentation than just the parent.
Right, right. And then I would either the same day or that very next day, send a letter, take a letter down to the school and bring up what your concerns are. And, if you can, take them copies of the photos that you took and talk about it and make them sit down and give you some kind of explanation about what's happening and what's going on. And definitely sort of write a letter about your concerns that you present at your meeting. And then if there's some kind of resolution or something that's going to happen, sort of write that second confirming letter after your meeting. Sort of depending on the extent of how bad you think it is, you want to include whoever you think you need to on the letter. So, oftentimes I hear parents say that they've sent letters, to the principal and no one's paying attention to them and they've sent 3 or 4 letters. And that's when I would suggest sending copies and putting a little CC at the bottom of your letter to people all the way up the chain. Include the next district level person, administrator, the assistant principal, whoever it is that you can think of. I've seen parents who put their local representative on the letter so that everybody sees it And eventually, you know, the right person sees it and knows that you're serious.
How long can you keep putting up with this? I mean,
well, when it comes to,
you know,
like,
parent,
yeah.
It's terrible to, you know, you see your kid coming home hurt. You think you want to send him back the next day?
Right.
The only reason why I sent Jeremy back was I totally trusted the paraprofessionals that were with him.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was surprised that nobody said anything, but I thought, well, maybe they didn't notice it because, you know, these kind of things sometimes you don't see because it's covered with the shirt.
Right.
As soon as I mentioned it, they said, oh, you know, that was the OT. So then, you know, I very much trusted the paraprofessionals.
Mm-hmm.
But in other occasions, when I've had a situation such as this occur, there's no way you want to send your kid back. Can you send your kid back?
Yeah, it's most definitely a difficult situation. It's something to ask them about creating some kind of plan about what's going on. Like if this is, in fact, another student that they're having trouble with, then another student, you know, is biting them or hitting them.
A school bus too.
Right. It could,
maybe
it could
be. Maybe they're not seeing it. Maybe it's on the school bus.
Mm-hmm. So you definitely need them to give you some kind of concrete responses. To the extent you feel comfortable, if you think there needs to be some kind of police report written, then call the police and have a police report written about it.
How soon after would they have to give you like an emergency IEP?
In California, you have to have an IEP within 30 days.
Oh, my God.
Of a written request.
Like,
right. It is that long.
There is no emergency IEP situation?
There's no provision that I know of that shortens the time for an IEP. But I think, at least sort of legally speaking, but I think if you were to write a letter, you know, stating out this kind of emergency situation, although it would look bad for them not to immediately address these concerns.
Right.
So there's nothing that specifically says, you know, if this happens, you have to have an IEP immediately. But I think it's in their best interest to do so because, you know, this is a big issue that's going to come back and that won't just go away. And they know that if it gets worse, more people are going to be looking at the circumstance, and the school wants to look as if, you know, they're doing everything they can.
Right, and you also have to be very careful to cover your butt as the parent, because I know that's not a very good legal term, but as a parent, they will turn around and try to make it like you're the bad person. This has happened to me where I've had a situation with my child, and they never called Child Protective Services, and they should have for this thing that happens because it concerns some other things on campus.
Mm-hmm.
And so and legally they were supposed to, or the teacher should have. I mean, it's written in specifics of what the responsibilities are. And so I called Child Protective Services, and the next thing that happened is they were checking me out and checking my daughter's school out, which I was totally fine with. But
right.
I was thinking, you have to be really careful that, you know, they're not going to turn around and say, well, it's happening at home. So you have to make sure that you have, you know that they're going to come look at your house too. And
right.
Be comfortable with the questions they ask you and not get emotionally upset about it. You know,
right.
I just knew, okay, it's part of, you know, they have to do this. So if I'm going to call Child Protective Agencies, then they're going to go and ask me questions too, and they're going to come to the house, fine.
Mm-hmm.
No problem with that.
Right.
But you just have to be ready for that, because if you're going to point your finger and ask questions, they're going to turn around and do the same to you.
That's right, which is also why it's important to take your own pictures and to go
correct.
To your own doctor.
At the end of the day, the Child Protective Services or any authority is going to be looking for the child's interest.
Right.
Not the school, not the parent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so
very good point.
Be careful about that. Okay, I didn't realize I had so many legal issues. Before I started looking at some of these questions, I'd say, oh, I know this one. Oh, I know this one. Oh, I've been through that. That doesn't mean it's true. It's the same for everyone, but I try to remember things from the practical point of view that parents may not think about, because emotionally, as a parent, it's harder. It's easy to say, well, here's the legal issue that you can refer to, or here's what you should do legally, but parents, you have to be ready for the emotional baggage that goes along with the steps that you are going to take.
Right, because unfortunately things don't happen as quickly as we'd like it to.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Okay, here is Warren from Sydney. Our 13-year-old daughter is achieving well in high school, but as I'm a retired teacher, we have been to her school twice to ask for social skills and academic lesson notes to help our daughter at home. Their response was, leave it to us. I was appalled. So now I spend all of my waking hours writing social skills lesson notes. Interesting.
Well, I mean, social skills is definitely a related service that can be provided by a school district. You know, there are many students who have, like, social skills therapy. It's kind of like a play group where they, you know, learn to appropriately take turns. And essentially all those social skills that students kind of naturally learn while playing together, to listen to someone, to follow directions, you know, to take turns and be polite and those kinds of things. So that is a service that a school district can provide. It's often a separate service because, you know, the student needs extra support in learning that kind of skill, and they're not just going to pick it up because they're in class or they're on the playground. And just like any other service that a student gets, it should always be documented in their IEP about when they're going to get it and how often, and if there is a service, that they should have a goal connected to that service. So for every service that's provided in the IEP, there should be a related goal to explain, you know, why they need that service and the kind of progress we expect the student to make from getting that kind of therapy.
And Cynthia in North Carolina just wrote in to say that ARD stands for Admission Review and Dismissal, essentially an IEP, how to address school systems restraint and seclusion policy and practice, which only requires a reporting to parents 30 days after incident.
For seclusion and restraint policies? Well, each state has different laws regarding, unfortunately, seclusion and restraint. But if the school's policy is really 30 days after something that important happens, knowing that that's the policy, you can request that something different be written into your own IEP.
Okay.
So that's one thing that, you know, parents often overlook the power of the note page that's in the IEP, at least sort locally. And I'm thinking that all IEPs have a page where there's sort of a narrative of maybe an explanation of a certain service or where the offer is written kind of in a paragraph. Or if there's some new agreement that happens during your IEP meeting about how something's going to happen, like there's a homework log or there's a communication log or something like that, if you can get your IEP team to agree that certain things are going to happen, it becomes the new rule for your child, even if it's not a rule for anybody else. So if you know that your, you know, student has, they have a behavioral plan, and they have certain behaviors that are going to get addressed by a behavior aid, or that you know in the past they've tried to use restraints before, and, you know, you have a behavior plan to avoid the use of those things, you can write in your IEP that if, you know, such a situation happens, these things, you know, will occur. There will be a call to the, you know, to the parent that same day. There will be a report by the teacher, you know, by the next day. We're going to have a meeting to discuss what happened. Like, the parents can set out those steps and have them agreed to in your IEP so that that happens, even if, you know, according to some other distant policy, they might not be required to give you a report till 30 days later. You can create your own policy, essentially, in your IEP document.
Okay. Here's a question from Lisa Marie in Eastern Pennsylvania. Here's another, this is another favorite question for me that I've never had the experience with, but I hear it all the time. For a young child who's diagnosed on the autism spectrum but is more like Asperger's, some ADHD, sensory issues, PDD, NOS, et cetera, at what point should a parent consider medication? Our school has made suggestions that perhaps he should be on meds. As a parent, what would indicate that you should go down that path?
Wow. I mean, I would think that's a, you know, highly personal and individual choice. The school, though they may suggest, really should not, their role is not to tell you that their job would be easier if your child was on medication.
Correct.
And so they, you know, need to create a program that addresses your child's needs, however they, you know, your child goes to class that day. And so I think it's really a conversation to have, you know, sort of in your own family and with your primary physician about the benefits, about what they can expect, you know, if they start medication, if there's alternatives that they should try beforehand, if there's other kinds of, you know, implementations that can happen at school with whether it be behavior or any other kinds of services that can help with whatever they think are the symptoms that the medication will address.
Right.
But the school should not be, you know, it's not really appropriate for them to be pressuring parents to try to medicate their child.
Right.
Yeah.
I would just like to say that medication oftentimes takes care of the symptoms, but it doesn't cure the problem or take care of the situation. And from what I've seen of professionals that work really well with students or children with autism is that medication could be like part of a whole program that you're, you know, if you've tried different things and nothing else is working, or you have a whole program where you're working on sensory issues through sensory integration or teaching the child to self-regulate or things like that, but not the the medications aren't going to help the child learn how to handle those things.
Mm-hmm.
So medications can be helpful as part of an overall program, but it's not a solution. So it's not like, as you say, the school can't suggest that your child should be on meds and everything is going to be hunky-dory if he is, because it doesn't work that way.
Right. Yeah, most definitely.
Okay, so someone in Canton, PC Lal, would like to know, how do we find an attorney who has experience representing children on the spectrum in the state of Michigan? So how do you do if you are in a state in the United States, where do you find out who has experience with autism?
Well, I think, as we mentioned earlier, the Protection and Advocacy System is a good resource. Because they would have a referral list and could give you information, so your local protection and advocacy. But also the Disability Rights Education Defense Fund is a national organization, and on their website, I believe you can search by state for attorneys. You know, and then when you call and ask, I mean, you really, parents should not feel embarrassed about asking, you know, specific questions about what kinds of clients special education attorneys work with.
Well, what about if you want to hire an attorney,
mm-hmm.
find out, besides talking to other parents, I always say talk to other parents, but how would you find out what attorneys in your area have experience with autism?
You know, I would, you can go to usually like community events, where there's like the legal booth and there are attorneys that are there. You can become familiar with kind of the attorneys who are often at similar kinds of events. And so you see that they work in a particular community. But it's often, and if they have a website, if the law office has a website where they give more information about the kinds of areas they practice in, but it's really about asking questions.
Okay.
And just calling them up and seeing what they specialize in, because there are such a broad array of disabilities that fall under special education law that there could be a special education attorney that doesn't, you know, have very many cases of students that have autism, and maybe they specialize in things like more like learning disabilities or orthopedic impairments. And so, yeah, it's really about asking those kinds of questions and seeing what their experience is.
Yeah, asking parents in your area is a great way as well.
Yes.
Okay, and so the same parent asks, our son was diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome. He is in special education program, being accompanied by a number of paraprofessionals who all give different directions to him. As a result, he's more confused. We have tried to get a single paraprofessional, but the school system has not been responsive to us at all. We cannot get the school to even meet with us at our request. They want to dictate everything. It is fairly affluent district with a lot of facilities, but they refuse to provide the help the child needs. In some ways, they impose too much help, making conditions restrictive and suffocating. We cannot get any cooperation from the school. Is there a way to deal with the school staff? Now, are they allowed to just if they say we cannot get the school to even meet with us at our request, if they ask in writing, don't they have X number of days to have a meeting?
Yes, they should be having an IEP meeting within their time frame. They can't just ignore you. So it's come to the point where they're ignoring their legal requirements. Then that's sort of stepped up the situation to something where you might need some assistance in, either filing a complaint or looking to bring, an attorney in to start, the process of requesting a meeting and seeing if they'll listen to the attorney. Because sometimes, there are instances in which even the local school doesn't even listen to the attorney sending in the letter, and you have to decide, well, we're just going to move forward and ask for a due process hearing on all of these issues because they're not getting a lot of response at the local level. But they definitely can't just ignore your request. They can't ignore any of your requests for an IEP meeting, for an assessment. That's part of the importance of putting things in writing because for all of these things, there are timelines for responses. Even if the response is no, there needs to be a response in writing to you, detailing why and the reasoning, behind their refusal to do something.
Right. I would say, too, that oftentimes if they're not giving you a meeting, I know you say that sometimes they ignore attorney's letters, but sometimes attorney's letters help to get that meeting
right.
going.
Right, exactly. And you can always, in speaking to the attorney, in looking for help from an attorney, you don't have to necessarily hire them for sort of the whole shebang and think that you need to hire them and put down this big money retainer and you're going to go to due process, and that's why I have the attorney. You can, ask for a consultation and see if they'll help you write a letter or if they'll write a letter, on their own letterhead asking for something specific or some kind of discreet, action that you want them to take for you and have it be kind of a limited scope of something that you want an attorney for.
Right. Okay, here's a really interesting comment from BL Cause from Slidell. Why do parents have to advocate at public schools and federal agencies? I understand if I'm trying to get my son in a private school or privately owned extracurricular activity, i.e. horseback riding. But when it comes to tax dollars and public entities that are being paid by my tax dollars to provide his education in various federally mandated services, I just don't understand why parents have to advocate for our child's legally sanctioned rights. To me, this is like telling President Obama he has to pay with his own credit cards to fly on Air Force One every time he takes a trip on the behalf of America's stateside and overseas interests. Your comments, Anna?
I agree, and I hear the frustration about, why a student's own school would sort of deny them services that they're completely legally entitled to. Ideally, what's frustrating and kind of paradoxical about special education is that when they were drafting the laws, they had envisioned this kind of, people coming to the table and having a team discussion and people coming to an agreement. That's sort of the ideal behind the IEP team meeting is that all of these different people come with their own perspectives of what the students' needs are, and you come together to create this program that addresses all of those aspects of the needs. And unfortunately, it's become much more adversarial than that. And I think they underestimated the extent to which school districts kind of have their own agenda, unfortunately, and it's not always the best interest of the child. Sometimes it's the lack of personnel. It's the lack of money. You know, they're trying to keep costs down, and that ends up negatively affecting a student's program. And it shouldn't be that way.
It shouldn't be that way, but the reality is it is that way, and that's why we have people like Areva Martin, who wrote this book, The Everyday Advocate, Standing Up for Your Child with Autism. You have to read and get educated and be able to advocate for yourself. And a lot of that, I mean, she writes about it in here, is about connecting with other people, because you're stronger when you have others with you than doing it on your own. But it's really important as a parent to get educated. You know, it's just like if you have cancer. It sucks if you have cancer. You don't want to get cancer, but you have cancer. What are you going to do about it? So it's the same thing. It's terrible that you have to fight for things that your child should automatically get, but that's the reality. So at some point, you just have to suck it up and go for it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, so.
Which I could use that language in court, could I?
Probably not.
Anyway. Okay, here are a few other. There are so many questions here. I don't know where to start. There are just too many of. Okay, here we go. Heidi in Columbia. I would like an out-of-school referral to a neuropsychologist, as my child has a gene deletion not known to be related to autism, but is known to affect learning. The school system did an evaluation using a school psychologist who does not have the skill set to do a full neuropsych evaluation. Please advise.
Well, that's part of what we were talking about earlier, about asking for an independent evaluation. And, you know, writing a simple letter saying, you know, I disagree with the recommendations of this evaluation. You know, I don't think the school psychologist is qualified to you know, do the proper assessments in this area, and I want a neuropsych evaluation. And they should be able, if not to give you a list of potential referrals, to at least approve the funding for one, so that if she goes to her primary, you know, doctor or like an insurance company, she can ask for a referral there. And find someone who has the proper training to do the evaluation that she'd like.
Right. And here's another question from Star Lazaro in Houston, Texas. Do you ask for assistive technology, such as an iPad for a nonverbal child, the same way as asking for any other assessment that is in writing?
Yes. You should always ask for any kind of assessment that you are requesting. You should always ask for it in writing. The easiest way nowadays is to send something via email, because, you know, you automatically can get proof that you sent it and what time, but you can fax it. If you're going to drop it off at the school, I always tell parents, you know, to ask the receptionist to initial it and date it and then give you a copy with her initials and the date so that you have proof that you gave it to somebody. But anytime you're going to ask for anything, an assessment or an IEP meeting, you always want to go ahead and put that in writing, because it's usually the writing and the proof of your request that triggers the timeline of when they need to respond to you.
Yeah, and oftentimes if you're going to be asking for assistive technology, they're first going to want to do an assessment. They usually have someone, whether it's the speech and language pathologist or they have a specific person who does the assistive technology assessments, they'll probably want to do assessments before they hand over any kind of technology, whether it's low
right.
or high tech technology.
And one thing to note too is for parents to be a little wary of when the school wants to do a screening instead of an assessment.
What's the difference?
Well, so a screening is usually someone at the school level doing something very simple. It's sometimes like a checklist, and essentially can be done by anyone. It's just like a screening. it just doesn't. There's no procedural requirements. An assessment requires that parent to sign an assessment plan that consents to the assessment being done and has formal what are called protocols that need to be followed in order to do an evaluation. So especially with assistive technology, we'll often see, you know, the school say, yes, we'll do a screening, don't worry about it. And so, you know, they'll bring in, I mean, sometimes it's even just the classroom teacher who kind of takes a look and says, oh, well, yeah, I guess maybe, you know, a keyboard could help. And it's just sort of observational, and it's not really driven by an assessment where, you know, there's data and there's a test and you get a report. Most often you see the difference because a screening doesn't normally generate an actual report where somebody will come, you know, to the IEP meeting where you can ask questions, where there's going to be recommendations, where they can tell you exactly what they did and why they came to the conclusion they did.
Now, that's not to say that it's not, that, I mean, it's probably a good idea for the teacher to be playing around and trying a few things out with the child, but that doesn't make it an assessment. That
right.
might be a way to kind of get a little handle on, because the teacher would like to try some things out to get a handle on, because oftentimes assessments, maybe that person may not be as familiar with the child and they won't have as much time as they'd like. The teacher can also help them with some information or at least a starting point. But it doesn't take the place of the assessment.
Right, right. Yeah, they can definitely be helpful and they have their own place. But if you think they've tried that, or if what you know what you want is an assessment, then you shouldn't be sort of deterred or, you know, just sort of tricked into thinking you got what you asked for, but you and actually, you know, got something less. There wasn't someone truly with the right sort of knowledge looking at what the possibility was.
Okay. Here's a question from Ruth Gardner in Buffalo, New York. My son is 11 years old and was in a program where they utilized a restraining type SCIP-TX for all issues, and after 6 months, he became very violent, self-injurious, and along with the medical issues, has not been in the program for the entire past year. I am being forced to send him back to his program, and none of my requests are being met, though my district, speech evaluation, functional behavioral evaluations, yet I'm being told I have no choice as this is the only school available for my child at this time. What would you do? I have paid for homeschooling, tests, et cetera, to try to reduce his aggressions and believe I do or should have other options, but I'm being reported to Child Protective Services through my district and fear I will be forced to send him back to school that I feel put him in the position of severe aggressions to begin with. Please, I would so respect your opinion or advice.
Well, this kind of goes a little bit to what we were talking about earlier about the suspected neglect and trying, you know, to document these things. I mean, it sounds like it's come to the point where she should probably seek some more professional help. If there have been medical issues, he's been self-injurious, and they're still refusing to conduct the proper behavioral evaluations that would essentially give them information about why this is happening and what they could do to best, you know, address that and keep him safe at school. Because most importantly, he should be safe at school. I mean, safe from his own aggression, but also from, you know, those staff members who might not know what to do when his behaviors come out during the school day. So if she's really concerned that she's placing him back in a school that's not listening to her request for these evaluations, I mean, I would suggest looking for an attorney or an advocate that could give her some more advice, you know, based upon all the facts and details, because she, you know, to give her more options.
Yeah, it's really tough.
Yeah, it is. It's hard to, without sort of being local and knowing all of the sort of necessary details, you know, there's some difficult decisions, sort of even in the best of circumstances. But the school should definitely be, I'm surprised that they have said, you know, that they've refused to do a functional behavioral evaluation, because that from these facts, you know, sound like clearly it's indicated. A functional behavioral evaluation should occur whenever a student is either self-injurious or has behaviors where they injure others, you know, as a result of their disability. And it's a behavioral evaluation that's more in-depth than kind of the everyday behavioral evaluation.
Right.
They really look to see, you know, what the antecedent of the behavior is and why he's doing it and what happens when the behavior occurs to really create a very specific positive behavior support plan, you know, to support the student and make sure that they're safe at school.
And that's the important aspect, too, that a lot of people forget about is that it needs to come with a plan of what to do, and that plan needs to be implemented, because otherwise there's no reason to have that and that assessment done.
Right, and any assessment, you know, you want the assessment to give you information so that it can mold the kind of services that you're going to request and the goals that you create and agree to in your IEP. So there really shouldn't ever be an assessment that happens that doesn't get discussed or that doesn't result in something, because there's usually, you know, good information, unless you disagree with the results of it. But assuming, you know, you agree and there's good information, it should inform how you create your IEP.
Right. Here's Audrey in Absecon, New Jersey. My son is a fourth grader who has Asperger's and ADHD. He has already been suspended from school because he had a very bad meltdown that got extremely physical when the vice principal physically grabbed hold of him. He was throwing chairs and completely out of control. I've never seen him in this extreme state. It has only happened one other time, and that was with the same vice principal back in May. I have advocated to back away from him when he is in an upset state and asked the school to provide a sensory room so that he does run around the building trying to escape because he does not know where to go when he is in the fright and flight mode. They chase him around the school, and it is a complete circus. The saddest part is that he feels awful once he's calmed. This is having such a negative impact on him. I am so frustrated at this time of extreme behavior, as this type of extreme behavior only occurs in school. What can I do to be a more effective advocate regarding this situation?
I mean, I think connected to what we were just talking about, if she hasn't asked for a functional behavior assessment already, she should.
Appropriate time to do it.
Right. And that will inform, you know, what happens before he has a meltdown, and also hopefully will, if he doesn't necessarily need a behavior aid with him all the time, they could come to some understanding that maybe there needs to be a consult with, like, a behavior intervention specialist who
would
can
give advice on what to do besides chasing him around.
Exactly, who would help in creating a positive behavior support plan to tell the teachers and the administrators, you know, what should happen when he starts, you know, for his behaviors, how they can work with him instead of disrupting everything, really, and making the whole situation worse rather than better.
Right. Okay, here from Ellen in San Diego. Every year with budget cuts and class sizes getting larger, the school district's argument against mainstreaming with an aide is that the class size is too large for our child to be able to succeed in that environment. His teacher this year is advocating for mainstreaming, but the district reps push back, especially the school psychologist. He does not have any disruptive behaviors and is at the level of his peers in academics. The challenge for our child is socializing peers and attention deficit, being able to stay on task to complete work on time. Please advise. Thank you.
So I think, connected actually to our earlier conversation about placement and sort of as she mentioned, the school psychologist, you know, pushing back against the idea of mainstreaming, needing their own person to make a recommendation about placement and putting him in a mainstream classroom.
Right. And the thing is, there's a couple of things here. Is least restrictive environment, so even, and I'm assuming because they're saying mainstreaming that the child is in a special education class, so it's just for, you know, a certain number of hours or something. So there's least restrictive environment, but and I know you're going to get into the legal stuff about it, but the other thing I want to mention is, even though it's important to mention the academics, it doesn't matter. For example, someone like my son, who we did not know what he was able to understand until he was in high school because his communication was not that good,
mm-hmm.
he was able to get mainstreaming based on his needs for social skills and his needs to be able to sit for 2 hours because, you know, he has to learn how to sit and wait at the doctor's, and he has to learn to sit in the movies. He has to learn to sit.
Right.
And listen. Irregardless of whether he understood the material or not, it didn't matter. So, but, you know, we built the goals in his IEP, and then where would he learn that? Oh, he would learn that in a mainstream class. And this argument about there's too many kids in the class is just, you know, they're trying to turn you off course of what your goal is for your child, and you have to focus on what the goals are for your child and get that based in the IEP.
Exactly. And I think you raise definitely a good point for parents to remember that when the law speaks about what a student's unique needs are, they're talking about everything. It's not just the academic needs. I mean, unique needs include their social behaviors, their ability to communicate with their peers and to make friends, to interact with adults.
Right.
All of those things that are that we consider important for kids to learn as they become adults, that's a unique need. So, you know, her son who has trouble socializing, there should be sort of a recognition that socializing is a unique need. And so how are they going to address it? Is there going to be a goal, you know, about how to interact with their peers or, you know, how to start some kind of conversation or play, you know, appropriately on the playground, depending how old he is. And like you say, where that's going to happen. And in the conversation, where the program is going to happen should be the last thing you talk about. It should not drive the conversation. So what we normally think of happening is that the IEP should begin with, you know, your student's present level of performance and how they're functioning right now, what their needs are, and what kind of goals we want to create for the student, if they need any kind of additional services, and then knowing all of that information, what's the best place for that student, where they can get all of those things. And so there shouldn't be sort of this like predetermined idea that, you know, this student has always been in a special education classroom and he's going to stay there, so we should talk about him remaining in this very same place.
And also you have to remember that the IEP is a program, not a place. So you focus on the goals, and they're always going to try, not always, but a lot of times they try and distract you by talking about where it's going to happen and where he's going to spend his day. But what you want to get the discussion back on is, what are the goals and what is he going to learn? And then where is that going to happen? Because you can creatively write the goals in such a way that, well, you have to make sure that the goals are measurable.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you can write goals if everyone agrees upon them. And then, you know, if they can take place in the mainstream environment, then the discussion is, why can't it?
Right.
It's the least restrictive environment.
Right. So, yeah, and parents should remember that the starting place, whenever we're talking about least restrictive environment, you know, we think of you start in the general education classroom, that all
Correct.
Students begin in the general education classroom, and it's not until the school can show that they can't offer enough support in that general education classroom that you start to think about a different setting. And make them explain what is it that they can't offer that, you know, requires them to take the student out of that general education classroom.
Right. And, you know, there's so much that they can do in the least restrictive environment. I mean, basically, unless they're hurting the other people in the classroom or really hurting themselves to an extent that, you know, it's really, really awful and there's nothing they can do about it, that's one, you know, thing. But if it's just because they think the class is too big, that's not an excuse for not having your child in there.
Right, right.
Okay, so more questions here. I love this one. Abby Rich from Rennieville, Kentucky. My son's first grade teacher last year told me on the side that he really needed a one-on-one teacher, but if I said she recommended it, she would deny it. How can I effectively advocate for his needs in a classroom if his teacher or who is in the classroom won't back me up? Now, I'm sorry, I shouldn't laugh, and I mean no disrespect against teachers, but I do need to explain to families out there that, because a lot of families get this, but some families don't, is that when you're in an IEP meeting, the teacher is basically in there with his boss. And
right.
So you have to, it's hard for them to say, oh, I think, this child needs a one-on-one, or this child needs this, because they're asking their boss for more money and for more things, which they know their boss doesn't really want to give or doesn't have the money to give, or they're kind of stuck because I have a perfect example of a teacher. She was a really good teacher, and she was up for tenure, and she wasn't going to get tenured because she was too much of an advocate for the kids, and too much of an advocate was that she would go in the meetings and say, yes, he needs a one-on-one. So it's really tough, and that's why sometimes they'll tell you things, but they have a hard time. You know, they're not going to appreciate it if you go in the IEP meeting and say, well, I know you said this. Why aren't you going to say it here?
Right.
What you have to try and figure out is ask your teacher. What I've always done that's worked is I try and find out if it's, you know, a teacher that I appreciate. You know, in most of the cases, it's always been. I'll say, what do you need to effectively provide the kind of education that my son needs, or the goals that are in his IEP, or that, you know, we're all thinking that he should be having. And then going into the IEP and asking myself for these things, and then you shift around and try and ask the members in the IEP what they think about it. And, you know, the teacher, she may not, in this case, it's saying the teacher won't back you up. But oftentimes, if you have an understanding with the teacher, you can work something out. I had a case where a teacher who had just been told that she wasn't going to get tenured because she was too, but she needed some letters of recommendations. My son's IEP was coming up, and she was going to suggest, because she believed that my son should try to be mainstreamed in some academic classes, and she called me up the night before and said, I can't do that because I need them to write letters of recommendations. So we worked it out. I knew who else was going to be in the IEP meeting, but half the people, I had no clue what they were going to say. And then I knew there were three people that were going to say, no way.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so, but she did say that if I brought it up, that she would give her opinion about it, but she couldn't bring it up.
Right. And I think that's an important point, is that if you can, if you can say the part that's hard for them to say,
right,
so that they can agree with you, or if you can highlight something like a need that they've already pointed to without coming to the ultimate conclusion,
right?
Then you can kind of say, well, I heard, you know, that his math teacher say that he has trouble doing X. I think that means he needs, you know, this kind of service, or so that you kind of pull their support without necessarily making them say the words that are so hard for them.
Yeah, you're talking about the supports and needs the child needs. So you don't say he needs a one-on-one teacher, but you say he needs prompts for this, or he needs to focus. He needs the help of a person to focus on this, or he needs help transitioning from here to here, or whatever it is.
Right.
And, well, how are we going to help him with that? Oh, he needs somebody to help him with that. Oh, well, what do you think about that, or what do you think your solution is? So that allows the teacher to voice her opinion without hotspot.
Right, right, exactly. And creating that sort of list of the needs, especially when you're talking about wanting a one-to-one aid, you start to compile a list that looks like a lot for the teacher to take care of, so that you can, like you mentioned, you can point to and say, you know, are you as a teacher able to do all this? Because I know that, you know, you have all these other students and you have other obligations. Do you have enough support in order for this to really happen?
Right.
You know, and everybody to do a good job at it, and then it kind of it lessens the pressure for them to be able, you know, to give support to the idea that no, I can't do all of this, or you know, yes, an aid would be helpful, and to help you in making the case for that extra service that you want.
I mean, it's really tough on a lot of teachers, because you'll see in these meetings the director will turn around and say, well, so you can take care of this, or you'll take care of it. Well, of course they're going to say yes. It's their boss.
Right.
What are they going to say? No, I'm sorry, I can't.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right.
It's really tough. And, you know, it takes a while to figure that stuff out when you're a parent because you have to look at the whole hierarchy of who's in there.
Mm-hmm. Right. You got to think that sort of everybody has their... Everybody comes to the table with their own kind of pressures and their own agenda. And unfortunately, not everyone's thinking about creating the best program because, you know, like you say, the teacher is sort of pressure with the employer, you know, sitting at the table, that assistant principal is thinking about, you know, maybe their budget constraints or their personnel and how many, you know, aides she has stretched across the school. The more you can kind of make the case to get everybody's support in the way they, you know, the only way they can give it, the better chance there is for you to, you know, it's harder for them to say no once you've got everybody agreeing on this long list of needs that need to be met in some way.
Okay, and I have to make a couple comments here that somebody just sent in. Lisa Lieberman from Lake Oswego. Actually, I know Lisa very well. She's actually an author as well of books, one in particular that has to do, and gosh, the name is escaping me, and I'm hoping she's going to type it in, but it has to do with hiring people to help you at home, you know, as most of us need support with some of our children. But she made some really good comments. The last question about the boy who became self-injurious, it is so important to mention that our kids become victims of post-traumatic stress syndrome when they've been subjected to an environment that doesn't honor their sensory needs. This boy needs someone who knows how to work with post-traumatic stress disorder. She says that to make sure you mention that PTSD, when children start to display aggressive or self-injurious behavior like this, they need to be evaluated for it because it can become a mental health issue and it needs to be treated or it will get worse. It's true. I understand what she's saying because it's showing that they've been traumatized. And so even if we feel that it's not a reason for them to having been traumatized, obviously something's happened that they're reacting that way. And so... it's a really good point that Lisa makes. In fact, signs that a child is reacting a certain way could be that he's been injured or abused in some form, or, you know, he's having huge sensory overload issues, which mm-hmm. is a form of abuse for a person if they can't control any of that. So those are good comments that Lisa made, and I hope she's still listening and will write in the title of her book, but you can Google her, Lisa Lieberman, Lieberman. Her book is really a valuable book for when you're hiring in-home support person. I think it's called The Stranger or This Stranger Among Us. And it's important for people who need 24-hour care for their children when you're needing resources about how do you find people, how do you supervise people, what kind of concerns there are. Okay, going back to some more, did you have any comments you wanted to make about that?
No, I think those are all really, really great points.
Okay. Is there anything else you would like to bring up? We have about 7 more minutes. I have more questions, but...
go ahead.
Did you want to mention anything about Ariva's book or about her work with the nonprofit that she's...
You did mention her nonprofit is called the Special Needs Network, and it's based here in Los Angeles. And sort of our goal with the Special Needs Network and the legal side of the office often works closely with the nonprofit side, is really to empower parents and to know that, you know, learning to be a better advocate for their own student means, you know, becoming educated and reaching out to parents and learning how to articulate what you already know about what your child needs and sort of reaching out and creating that sense of community so that, you know, as parents you feel supported when you need to ask for something, when you want to find out how something works or you just need, you know, some kind of moral support. 'Cause oftentimes I've seen parents who are you know, they can be really articulate and feel really comfortable, but it's always helpful to just bring a friend along sometimes to that IEP meeting to keep you on track and to kind of remind you that, you know, maybe you need to take a break because, you know, there's some kind of issue that kind of they know how to push your buttons on and they know how to take you off topic. And so creating that supportive environment for parents where they can learn, you know, sort of not necessarily the, you know, super technical legal aspects of it, but enough that they know their rights and they know what to ask for, I think is really an important part of what we talked about before of educating the community so that people know at least the right questions to ask so that they can feel like they really are a part of the decision-making process and they're not just being talked at and being, you know, given this program, that they really are a part of the IEP team and they are the parent and they have a say about how this process, you know, goes and that they feel like they're being heard.
Right. I always tell parents that they should look at an IEP meeting as if it were a business meeting because that's really what you're doing is you're negotiating what your child is going to receive for that coming year. And so you really have to focus on that. And having, as you say, someone with you helps, A, keep you on track and also to take notes because oftentimes you're so busy listening that you don't always hear, or you're so busy talking, you don't always hear the different subtleties of what was said.
Right. And to come prepared, I think it's a great analogy to think of it as a business meeting where, you know, you've taken a few minutes to sort of jot down the important things that you want to talk about, to almost have your own agenda so that you don't forget something that you wanted to bring up and so that you stay on topic, so that if, you know, you run off topic, you know that you can come back and keep talking about, you know, that particular, you know, subject that your child isn't doing very well in or some particular issue that you have about, you know, the homework or something like that, so that all those important points get talked about.
Very good. Well, we're coming to the end of our show here, and I did want to remind people that there exists this really good resource, the book called The Everyday Advocate, Standing Up for Your Child with Autism, which was written by Areva Martin, and who's the president and co-founder of the Special Needs Network, and also who has the law offices of Martin & Martin, of which Anna Rivera, the attorney who's been with us this evening answering questions, works at and for. I hope that you'll give our best to Areva and tell her that we missed her, even though we're very happy that you were here.
I will definitely pass that along.
And I'm sure, do you know if there's a particular website for Areva? I'm sure that people can just Google her and find her.
I believe it's www.arevamartin.com.
But anyway, I'm sure if you Google her name, you'll find her.
You'll most definitely find her.
Thank you so much. Did you have anything more you wanted to say, Anna, before we bid you good night?
Thank you very much. They were really wonderful questions, and it's great to hear, you know, parents wanting to learn and become, you know, better participants in this whole process and knowing that they have the right to sort of speak up and be heard. And it's always important to know that and to know that there's always something new to learn.
That's right. And keep on standing up for your kids because if you don't, nobody will.
Right. Be persistent.
Be persistent in a nice, friendly way. So good night, everyone. It's been a pleasure to be here, and hope you will be here next month when there's another MomsFightingAutism.com webinar. And until then, be the change that you would like to see. Good night, everyone.